Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Michelle Jax. Michelle is a devoted mum of two who has lived with ARFID since her son started weaning. Through Michelle's own experiences of supporting her son with ARFID, she has become a passionate advocate for ARFID, working tirelessly to raise awareness and support those who are also struggling with ARFID. ARFID is often misunderstood, yet its impact extends far beyond food. It shapes daily life, family dynamics, and emotional well-being. Michelle's journey is a reminder that we really need to change the way in that people are being supported, and there is so much more room for improvement to make sure that people are getting the support and understanding that they need. I loved speaking to Michelle as she is such a wonderful individual, but hearing Michelle's story was really, really heartbreaking. People shouldn't be having to struggle and fight for treatment in order to support their loved ones with their eating disorder, and they shouldn't be met with the misunderstanding that Michelle has been. I wanted to share this episode this week because it's Eating Disorder Awareness Week, and the message behind this week is that anyone can be impacted by an eating disorder. And I don't like to drill on about the stigmas of what we might assume, because I think that only builds a stereotype. But what I do want to say is that yes, Michelle's son is the one struggling with an eating disorder, but actually Michelle and her family are being massively impacted as well. So I'm reframing the Eating Disorder Awareness Week and focusing on actually the eating disorder doesn't just impact the individual, it impacts everybody around them as well. Michelle, it is so lovely to have you on the podcast. I laughed so hard when we met at Parliament, and then I didn't realise that it was you that I'd met at Parliament.
You know what's really funny? I think it was just because of the scenario and the scene, and it weren't until after I went, oh, Andy, that's who just messaged me about doing a podcast. And he was like, stop it. And I was like, no, I'm being serious. Someone else, and I feel really bad.
Well, I'm glad that you didn't join the dots either, because I felt so bad.
Until you were speaking and you mentioned your podcast, and I was like, oh my God. But then I was like, it's too late now to be like, by the way.
No, because I hadn't even realised. So I would have been, I mean, maybe that it was good you didn't say anything. I think I'd be mortified if it was in person.
That's the thing though, isn't it? You don't necessarily know someone in person. That's just life though, right?
Yeah. Literally, yeah. And actually from that event, when I spoke, I had about four people come up to me and was like, oh my God, I didn't realise you were Hannah from Full of Beans. And I was like, well, yeah. But I guess a lot of people will know my voice, but not my face.
Yeah, exactly, so, yeah. I suppose to do it in a podcast, isn't it? Everyone knows your sound, not necessarily what you look like.
Yeah, exactly. But thank you so much for joining me, and I'm really excited to chat to you. I just wondered, did you want to introduce yourself for the listeners?
Yep. So I'm Michelle. I run the page ARFID Life UK. I am a mum to a 5-year-old who has got ARFID. And yeah, our journey's been quite hard, but I wouldn't change it, to be honest. As much as I would love not to be living with it, I do think sometimes you're with this for a reason. I think a lot of stuff, isn't it? It's definitely changed me as a person. I'll give you that.
Wow, amazing. And I guess, you know, if you're happy to go into it, the journey that you've gone through, how did that all start for you in terms of kind of, because I don't think a lot of people even know what ARFID is. So how did you start to come to that realisation?
So I think for us, like, Arlo's our second. So as soon as we kind of started like the weaning process as you normally would, we just expected it to be, you know, textbook. You know, you're reading the books, kids should do this, that and the other when they eat. So we was like, yeah, we know what we're doing. We've done it once before. And it got to about 10 months old, I think it was. And I was just a bit like, okay, this is different. You know, he hated like the sensory aspect of the food. He hated lumps and bumps and textures. Just would spit them out, would gag. It was just not what we expected. And we kind of was a bit like, oh, okay, maybe it's a phase. It's his age. Maybe he's not ready. And then as time went on, I was like, this isn't, and I hate the word normal, but it was kind of like, it's not normal to what it should be as a kid eating, basically. And he was quite poorly at birth and stuff. So he was already under a paediatrician. So I kind of mentioned it to them, and then he had his 2-year check, and again, I brought it up, and obviously the markers come back quite low. So they did quite early on refer him to a dietitian, which we are really grateful for. He was very young the first time we saw him. But again, we was kind of hit with the whole, he's just a fussy eater. you know, he's just a child. It's neophobia. He's going to grow out of it. And I was like, yeah. Okay. Kind of believing him, I suppose, at that time, because I didn't really know what ARFID was. And it was only that we actually moved house that we spoke to the dietitian, and he said, like, you know, they discharged us because we was moving 3 miles down the road. And he's, yeah, exactly that. 3 miles down the road and they discharged us. Bearing in mind at that point, he actually wasn't really eating. And he was the first person that said to me, it wouldn't surprise me in 10 years time if you tell me he's got ARFID. And I was like, what's that? What's ARFID? Like, what are you talking about? And he was like, okay, so good luck with your journey. Bye. And I was like, you've just dropped a bomb. And that's what it felt like. I was like, someone's just dropped this term at me. And I was like, well, what's that? You've just left me with no dietitian. The pediatrician's also discharged us. So I was like, you've just left me in no man's land. And he was 2.5. And I was like, I've got a 2.5-year-old who at that time was maybe eating 6 things, which was only skips, sort of jammy dodgers, wafers, like things that were like air, eating air basically, and drinking a lot of milk. And I was like, what do I do now? We'd obviously gone back to the bottom of the pile, had kind of just been dumped. So then, yeah, my journey of what the hell is off, it begun. And yeah, it's avoidant restrictive food intake disorder. It was just a bit of a, it was a bit of a shock. I knew it was always something more than picky eating. And as soon as I read like the criteria and started reading into like the subtypes, I was like, wow, this is him. Mm-hmm. But then I was like, I've got no one to talk to about it because I've just been discharged from everyone.
Yeah. And I can imagine, you know, not whenever I kind of speak to parents that have supported a child or loved one through an eating disorder, you instantly just want to help. You want to do something. And I can imagine that for you, it was like, well, you know, not only is this happening to my child, but I haven't even got a clue what this term is that someone's just landed on me.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to go with this?
Yeah. I literally remember ringing my husband going, so what's ARFID? And he was like, I don't know. So then, yeah, we had to go hardcore researching. On top of that, I obviously had to fight with the local services to try and get him back onto the list for another dietitian and a paediatrician, and which that in itself was a huge battle. And then through all of that, we kind of got told just to get on with it, live with it, you know, he's fine, don't worry. And I was like, well, hang on a minute. A dietitian has told me this information. He can't have said it for nothing. And in the end, because I knew that we weren't going to get seen for a very, very long time, we ended up getting him diagnosed privately because I was just like, I can't. I wanted the answers before we then saw a paediatrician so I could be like, he has ARFID. But actually looking back, it kind of backfired. Because we then got refused from kind of seeing speech and language, and they all said no because he had a diagnosis. So even that in itself, yeah, even that created massive barriers. So it was just like, have we done the right thing?
Yeah.
Now what have I done?
Wow.
Yeah. And so, I think looking back, you never know what to do for the best, do you? You don't know. Well, I didn't know what I was doing. I just was crying out for help. So I was just looking at everything and anything and thought, oh, I'll just get him diagnosed because he's got it.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, I've kind of, part of me actually wishes I didn't get him diagnosed,
really?
which is a funny thing to say, really.
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting. But it's actually really interesting that you brought that up, because just before we came onto this call, I was writing about the pros and cons of getting a diagnosis. And
okay.
So that's really interesting that you brought that up. And I think it was a big point that I was kind of thinking about in terms of almost pigeonholing yourself because of the diagnosis. And I was having the conversation with somebody this morning as well, who was saying that they kind of knew that potentially that they had depression, but also were kind of thinking about PTSD. And they basically, they didn't get a formal diagnosis before this, but they pigeonholed themselves as well, because they went along to the doctor, like you're saying, and like we do massively recommend to say, it's like, get all your ducks in order, you know, take everything, all the information with you, and take that to the doctor and say, this is what's happening, you know, I know what I need, da da da. But then actually, you know, in your instance, they're saying that backfired. So where did you go from there in terms of if, you know, you couldn't have access to that treatment?
So we finally saw the paediatrician, and they referred us on, because it's like a community paediatrician, they forwarded us on to like the one in the hospital, which then the hospital have referred him. We tried Great Ormond Street 3 times, I think, and they said no. Which I was a bit like, okay, at this point, he was only eating yogurt and drinking milk, which obviously isn't a lot. And I was like, we're desperate. And then they obviously refused. So I was like, well, now what? And then the other only other option was obviously the Evelina, which thankfully they have accepted. We should hopefully be seen within the next 2 or 3 months. Fingers crossed. We've been waiting for quite a while. And bearing in mind, he's now 5. I've been fighting this battle since he was 2.5. I'm only just potentially going to see him. So it's been all this time. I've had MPs involved. I've had everyone involved because we're just getting nowhere. And last July, he was very poor. He had his appendix out and now he don't eat at all. He's just drinking milk and supplement shakes. And even that didn't give the Evelina a good enough reason to see him any earlier. So you just think, well, you know, it's so hard when you're trying to live with it day to day. But actually, as well, I'm trying to find the energy and the power to fight, to actually get him the help in the first place. It's draining from so many different angles. And I think that's the hardest part about it. It's you're trying to live that moment with your young one, but actually at the same time, you're trying to push to actually get someone to help because he's so young and so tiny.
Yeah. Gosh. Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit lost for words, to be honest. I think that it's insane.
It is insane. And it's funny, like if you would have asked me, I don't know, 18 months ago, I would have said no chance. I wouldn't talk to anyone about it. It's really funny. Like I was always very guarded. You know, as younger, I was never that person that would stand up and talk in front of people. I just couldn't do it. I just wasn't me. But it got to the point where I was like, why is no one wanting to help him? Like, why is there this kind of, oh, he's fine, don't worry. And I'm like, no, he's not fine. What do you mean, don't worry? He's a growing child, you know, he's at school now. You know, why is it that they have just really potentially, well, they've just been left. And I kind of was a bit like, well, actually, if he can't use his voice, then I'll use mine, which I never knew I really had that much, to be honest. And now I'm like, oh, can't stop talking.
Yeah. Well, you're doing.
I think actually it's a good coping mechanism as well, I think. I think in a weird way, it's a way of coping, I think, for me anyway.
Have you found that you've, through sharing your experience, been able to connect with other people going through similar things, which I guess is sort of a positive and a negative in the sense that you have that community, but equally it's like there's other people going through this and they really shouldn't be?
Yeah. Oh, massively. Like as soon as I set up my Instagram page, I was like, wow. All of a sudden I was like, I'm not that one. I know I'm not the only person, but I suppose it's when you're physically seeing that you're not the only person and everyone's sending you the same messages and everyone's, all the kids are very similar, give and take, you know, obviously everyone has different preferred foods and stuff like that. It was just it's heartbreaking. It is really scary. And I don't know how long ago it was now. A couple of weeks ago, obviously, we did the thing on Sky, me and Arlo. And I underestimated how much attention it would draw because I'm just that blasé about life. And I actually had to put my phone down because it was heartbreaking. I said to my husband, I can't look at my phone any longer. I had message after message after message of people crying out for help. And I'm like, just because I've spoken up about it, I don't know if the answer's either. I am still in this journey myself. I am still trying to find him help. It's just, I suppose, because I'm more open about talking about it or happy to share things. I think people just are grabbing at every chance they've got. And I think that's the saddest thing about it. And I think it's the same most probably in all eating disorders, isn't it? You know, everyone wants that help. And I think when you're so desperate for it, you just go wherever you can. And it's just, it hits you on another level. And I actually find it more heartbreaking listening to other family stories. I think because I've processed ours, I've accepted it, I can deal with it, I manage. But actually listening to someone else's hits 10 times harder. It's really weird. I actually get more upset listening about someone else's child than Arlo because I've just grown to manage.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose, you know, in a sort of survival instinct way, Yes. You've had to do that. You've had to almost normalize the situation because if every time, you know, imagine you sat down at a meal and it's the same instance, if you were getting upset every time, you have every right to be, and the fact that you're not getting the support. But I suppose it's that would make the situation, you know, incredibly challenging. But it is, I think the thing that I always find particularly, I mean, I think eating disorder awareness in general and eating disorder support is not where it needs to be, but particularly with ARFID, I'll often find that people will kind of describe the symptoms of what they're experiencing or what a loved one is experiencing. And then I'll say, have you ever heard of ARFID? And they're like, oh, no, I haven't. And then you explain it and they're like, yeah, that's exactly me. But it feels like there's so little awareness about it that there's just not that support. But then on the same side, there is awareness, but then just quite a lot of stigma.
Yes. Oh, God, yeah. The stigma with it is just awful. And I think that's the scary thing. I think because people are leaning more towards social media for that help, because there isn't help anywhere else, really. I think a lot of it, you know, you are hit with negativity. I've actually been really fortunate. I don't actually think I've had any negative comments, but I think it's because I most probably approach it more from my angle rather mm-hmm. than it being Arlo specifically. I know I talk mm-hmm. about his story, but I keep him off of it. I'm talking more about, you know, how it affects me as a family, how it affects us in day-to-day life. So I do think we've avoided that. But, you know, the amount of comments I see on other people's things about, oh, it's just a picky eating, or it's bad parenting, or you've given up too early, or this wasn't around in my day. And it's kind of, you know, I've been told all these things to my face, you know, and I've now grown a tough skin that I can either turn around and tell them to be quiet or walk away from the situation. But it's, you know, even today, we've just literally been out for lunch and he's just sat there drinking his milk and you can see people staring at him. But now I've kind of grown that exterior of, well, why are you staring at him? Like, I'd actually rather someone approach us and say, are you not going to feed your child? So I can explain the situation rather than sitting there giving me daggers because I'm not feeding him. And I just think I wish people had the guts to say something sometimes. Like, my eldest daughter's got mobility issues. And for a very long time, we every like days out and stuff, she'd be in a wheelchair, and the amount of looks she would get, and I have bitten a couple of times, and my dad's been like, whoa, 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 and I'm like, no, I'm not having it. I'm like, you can't. And she was, you know, she's only young herself. You can't look at someone like that. You either stand up and you question what's wrong, or walk away. Don't look at someone, because, you know, he's only five, but he can still feel that.
Yeah, and I mean, I hope it's okay for me to ask this, but I guess for people listening that are thinking, well, what is the issue? If someone did come up to you and say, well, why aren't you feeding your kid? Why is he only drinking milk? How would you explain Arfid and Arlo's situation?
I would just be like, I think would point blank ask them, have you heard of Arfid in the first place? Mm-hmm. Or as much as I hate everyone using the thing as a being a picky eater, I would turn around and say to him, do you think he's a picky eater? Or do you think it's because I'm just, you know, letting him go away with it? And then I would say, you know, it's not picky eating, it is the extreme. You know, it is the fact that he's got major, major trauma to swallowing food. You know, before he dropped down to yogurt, he swallowed, I think it was a wafer, and he said, oh, that food really hurt my throat. And I was like, no, darling, it's fine. It's because you've got tonsillitis. But that stuck with him. So, you know, he's got that kind of like first pinpoint of trauma, like the aversive side of Arfid. And then as soon as he had his appendix out in hospital last year, we're not too sure whether it was maybe the taste from obviously where he was under general anaesthetic and things like that, or just the whole scenario of being in hospital. He then dropped his yogurts. So, you know, his is a lot of it is the trauma. And I would generally say to someone, you know, what's your worst fear? A spider, for instance. If I gave you this McDonald's box and stuck all loads of spiders in there and put it in front of you and you opened it, what would you do? You would get up and run a mile. So why would I do that to my son? Why would I give him a box, a McDonald's box full of food? Because he's going to run a mile. Because that's he's scared of it, basically. He's scared of food. And I always, that's the one way I explain it to people. Get your worst trauma or your worst fear, shove it on your dinner plate and tell me that you would sit there and look at it or touch it or smell it or eat it. You wouldn't. They wouldn't do it. But then people still look at you like you're crazy.
I think that analogy is fantastic.
Yeah, I always go with the spiders because I think it's always like, yeah. No one who likes spiders. I don't. I could be around them, but I'm not a fan.
It's so true though, isn't it? If I, yeah. You know, if you said to somebody, yeah, as you said, spiders or whatever, and you put it in front yeah. of you.
Or even heights, isn't it? You know, would you go and stand at the top yeah. of a bridge, or would you go and jump out of an aeroplane? No,
yeah.
You wouldn't.
And I think because I always find like eating sort of so tricky, because in the same respect of like recovery is so hard because you have to face food every day. Like, it's something that we all have to do in order to live. We have to eat. Mm. And so, you know, it's not like a fear of spiders. You don't have to face spiders. Like,
no.
You know, even if a spider comes into your house, you can ask someone to sort it out for you, but it's so different, which makes it even more powerful and more strong and more kind of, you know, difficult to navigate everyday life. But when you say to somebody, my biggest fear in life is food, they're just like, what the hell? Because everybody has that relationship with food of, well, we all have to eat. So I yeah. think it's it's both so rational and so irrational that people just can't really comprehend how it can be that terrifying.
And I think food is such a sociable thing, isn't it? Like, I think the hardest thing we found was switching our mindsets to actually not feeding him. That was the hardest part because, you know, us offering him food or asking him to sit up the table or does he want something to eat was actually making him more uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit like, how do I now switch my brain of finding a different way to approach him so that I could make sure that he's still drinking enough? Because obviously we have that, you know, he still has to drink, you know, at the minute, especially is the only thing he's having. It's trying to find that way around it, which is really hard, even cooking dinner. You know, to be honest, we've been very fortunate. He is getting better being around food. And I don't know if that's purely just from where he was quite unwell, that I just went with the complete everybody around me. I was like, you have to now not mention food in any way whatsoever. I was like, we cannot lose him drinking this milk. I was like, because we don't have anything else left. He'll end up being tube fed or whatever. I was like, you know, we have to all now stick together and leave it. If anyone's around, just leave it to me. And actually from stripping everything back, he now comes in the kitchen and waits for me while I'm cooking dinner. He sits up at the table waiting for me to have dinner and he sets himself his own little mat. No food, but he sits with us at dinner and he would have never have done that before. Even yesterday I was cooking dinner and I went, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm just going to sit here while you cook dinner. He said, and then I know where I'm sitting. I was like, don't cry. Because I was like, this is huge. Yeah. Like, that's a massive thing for someone who genuinely don't like food.
Mm.
But he now sits himself up at the table. Is it lunchtime? Is it dinner time? I'm like, oh my God, this is massive.
Mm.
Because, as I said to my mum, if we can just focus on the social aspect of food so that he can sit up the table with us, so that we could go to McDonald's or wherever with his sister, them things are massive wins because actually it's given us a bit of our life back. It's given him a bit of a quality of life rather than us going out and being like, oh, we've got to be back by lunchtime because he's going to find it too overwhelming. It kind of is giving us that little bit of hope that maybe when he's ready to change and he's ready himself, all of these things will be in place already to then help him really do the last part, which is eat.
Yeah.
That's what we can hope for. And
I mean, I don't know kind of if this is Arlo's experience, but I think, you know, speaking from my own experience of having an eating disorder, the food, it's all the things around it. The food is really tricky. And I said to my therapist the other day, I was like, the food was the easy bit. It was everything else. She was like, Hannah, the food was not the easy bit. Like, you just can't remember what it was like. I tell you now, the food was not easy. But it is, it's those elements around it, like eating with other people or, you know, having other people cook for you, that sort of thing, and trying new things. So it's incredible that you're able, you know, that you're having those wins. And I can imagine for you, that is so amazing to see, but equally I can imagine as his mum you're like inside screaming like, oh my God, yay, I'm so happy, like there's all this emotion.
Yeah.
But you've got to stay normal and you've got to kind of keep that down. And I was wondering, I mean, you said a little bit about like social situations and things, but I guess for the listeners, it'd be, if it's okay to ask, how it's impacted you, like your family dynamic and your life, because I can imagine it's, you know, eating is a big part of your life, but also he's your son, therefore a ginormous part of your life.
It's not been easy. I think the hardest thing more recently we notice is our eldest, like she's 8, and obviously she's becoming a lot more aware that his eating is not causing issues, because that's the wrong way to put it, I suppose, but it is putting hurdles in place. You know, me and my husband next year turn 40. In a lovely, ideal world, we would love to go take them anywhere. We'd love to go to Disney again in Paris, but we can't because he only drinks milk. We can't take it with us and we can't run the risk of him not drinking their milk. But obviously, then trying to explain that to an 8-year-old, all she wants to do is go back to Disneyland, but we can't. So it's, you know, just even those little things, you know, we're going away for a weekend in a couple of weeks. We was potentially going to drive halfway down the night before. I can't find anywhere to stay that's reasonable, that's got a fridge. To anyone else, what are you talking about? Just go and stay somewhere. Well, no, I need a fridge because his supplement shakes have to go in the fridge once they're opened. And he drinks, on average, could potentially be anything up to 3 pints of milk a day. So we need some fridge, we need a space. And, you know, even just those little things, But that's without, you know, that's just going out for days or going on holiday, but just day to day life. Just popping out to the shops, it's kind of, you think, okay, has he had a drink before we go out? Do we need to take one with us? At the minute, he's been very tired and very lethargic. We've just had some blood results back. His iron levels dropped again. So he's obviously very fatigued from that. So we're having to kind of gauge, if we go out, we can't walk very far. But then again, on the flip side of that, my daughter wants to go out. You know, she wants to do all of these things. And she's obviously got her own mobility issues, which then I can't push a wheelchair and carry a five-year-old. I could try. I've tried pushing them both, but it's impossible. You know, you don't realise all the little things. Her birthday's coming up, you know. What am I going to do about a birthday cake? Because he's going to still be there. You know, it's all of these tiny little snippets that you don't... Everything's evolved around food, isn't it? You go, it's someone's birthday, you have cake, you go out for dinner. Well, great. Well, they're the two things that he doesn't really want to be around. Can't tell him not to go. Can't be like, oh, sorry, mate, stay at home. And it's hard even just for me and my husband. I think it's been such a journey to... I've wrapped my head around it a lot quicker. I think because I'm at home all the time, I'm obviously with it a lot more than what he is. And obviously he's working, works quite a lot, bless him. So he comes home from work and obviously kind of sees snippets, which I suppose is harder. And I think, you know, Arlo is autistic, and from his own little diagnosis, bless him, my daughter is slowly unmasking hers. So obviously we're kind of doing that. And equally, my husband potentially too. So I think he's struggling to understand himself because he actually can see himself in being our son. So I think there's just so many different angles to it, isn't there? And what suits one autistic person don't suit another. And when you've potentially got 3 out of 4 in one household, even that dynamic is intense. Sometimes I'm like, okay, you all need to be just split up. You all go in a room each because... someone's going to pop in a minute, and you can see it. You can see everyone, you know, she wants to sit and eat a pack of Quavers. Well, they're the worst things you could put near him because he hates the smell. So I'm like, if you want to eat them Quavers, you're going to have to go upstairs or sit in the kitchen away from him, but then go and brush your teeth because you're going to smell cheese after. It's, you know, just the simplest of things. And they're the things that normally upset me the most. You know, as much as it's wonderful that he sits up the table, the amount of times he has set up the table, I'm like this, crying. Because I'm like, oh, he's up the table. But then the other part of me is heartbroken because obviously he's not eating. And I know it's wonderful that he sat there, but at the same time, it breaks your heart. It's weird. And I think with anyone, isn't it, emotions hit you at the worst time when you least expect it.
Yeah. And I suppose it's hard, isn't it? Because you obviously want to be really happy about those small, what seem like small wins, but are actually massive wins. But equally, you know, they're things that some people don't have to even consider.
No.
And, you know, I can imagine, you know, sometimes it's like, oh, that's amazing, but also like, this shouldn't be something that I have to even, you know, think about. And I guess, you know, it sounds so tricky again with that family dynamic, because it's, you know, your family, you want to go out and be able to do stuff together. And it's then tricky to navigate that when, you know, everybody's got different needs. And I can imagine that the like underlying anxiety as well of, you know, whatever is going to happen, that takes so much energy in itself.
Yeah. And I think as well, that underlying anxiety as well, if mine's higher, you can see he picks it up. So it's like you have to master masking your anxiety, which is quite hard, you know. And I do find going out for days is probably the most triggering, because even just, you know, having to make sure that I've got everything for him. It's then the, like you've said earlier, the stigma, the sitting down eating, and you can feel people's presence of looking, or, you know, then that starts to build your anxiety up because you think, well, what are you looking at? Like, just go away, I don't need this today. It's you don't realize you get it from so many different angles.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Michelle. And I think one question I wanted to ask is, because there is so much misunderstanding and lack of support, sort of in that ideal world, what would support for you and your family look like?
I think for us at the minute, I think it's really tough, and actually someone asked me this the other week. And I actually said, in an ideal world, I actually don't know what the support would look like. I think because there's so little research and so little evidence of what actually works, or there's no nice guidelines, I think no one knows what to go by. And I think that's the hardest part. I think they are missing a bit with the whole supporting the parents supporting the siblings. You know, it doesn't just affect us, it affects everyone. The grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, you know, it affects the whole family. And I think it's always that they try and focus on the person suffering the most, isn't it? And I get that. But then at the same time, if the people that are looking after them aren't in a good headspace, how can everyone work together? And I honestly don't know in an ideal world, like, you know, his weight and height's being checked. He's obviously on supplement shakes. God knows how many different medications and stuff. So he is at a good level. You know, we are keeping him going. But I think unless he's at an age where he can have some kind of therapy to help him with the trauma that he's got, like with the swallowing and things, I don't think we'll see a change for a very long time. And I think a lot of it is just going to be down to when he's ready. And I think that's the hardest thing, isn't it? It's kind of, and there is so many people saying, oh, you know, I need help. And it's like, well, actually, what help do you want? Because actually, no one knows the answer. And that's the hardest part, isn't it? You think someone's got to know the answer, how to help him. But actually, I don't think anyone does.
And I think that's such a tricky place to be, isn't it? In terms of, because like, if we thought about, I don't know, you've broken your leg, you don't go to the doctor and say, I need help. And they're like, well, what help do you want?
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine if they were like, well, what do you need?
They just put it back together, didn't they?
Yeah. But then in the same respect, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's just answered my question, actually. You would never say that for any other illness. So why this? But I think, like you said, you know, a really important piece there is the research is lacking, you know, not only, you know, because I think we're all aware that, you know, with eating disorders in general, it has to be individualized to the person.
Yeah.
But, you know, just to have some foundation of understanding, you know, some foundation of why these things happen, what can be helpful, if anything,
yeah,
kind of making a headway on that. And I do think that, you know, there are incredible people out there doing research, but just not enough.
And the thing is, anything like that doesn't come quick enough either, does it? You know, right. All this research is amazing, but everyone wants it like 2 weeks ago. You know, like we wanted it months ago. Everyone wants the answers now, don't they? They don't want to be waiting. And I honestly think, you know, especially families now like us, I think we're living that part of where there is very little knowledge. It is kind of like we are the guinea pigs in a way, which is awful because I don't want to be a guinea pig. But it is kind of like their stories, their data, the way that they're all living will be used for, you know, years down the line of how things are potentially formed and then put in place. And I think that's most probably the hardest part. And I think most probably that's why, for me, I just accepted it is what it is, you know. We've just got to take each day as it comes, make sure he's drinking enough, make sure he's putting on weight, and just roll with it. Because I think otherwise, it would eat me alive. And it did eat me alive at one point, because I was just like, why would no one help him? What do we do? What are we doing? Are we doing something wrong? And then it got to a point and I was like, actually, that's more damaging thinking like that, because it's not helping anyone, is it? It wasn't doing anything. It was just making me more sad and putting me in a bad place. Whereas actually now, I feel a lot more confident that we're doing everything we can to help him and just plodding along, which in itself isn't fair.
No. It isn't.
And I don't even know why I'm laughing, because I think sometimes if I don't laugh, I'll cry. And it's awful, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think you are absolutely incredible, and the strength that you have in, you know, I'm taking this shit situation and I'm going to raise my voice so that it helps us, it helps other people. I think, you know, it's absolutely amazing. It's not something you should be doing. You should have to do it. And so when I say, you know, the strength that you have, I mean it with the most compassion and also anger for you, because I don't think that anybody should have to do what you're doing in order to access treatment.
And I think the anger comes out more now. I think I just have days where I feel so angry. Mm-hmm. And that's normally when I'll start emailing local MPs and things. Because I'm like, someone's going to get it. I'm like, who's going to get the brunt of my anger today?
Yeah.
But even then, you know, not much comes off it, you know, because everything's so, it's so hard to get your voices heard, isn't it? Actually, I do think the hardest thing is to be heard in the first place. I think, and that's the hardest part about it. I think there's most probably so many families that are in these situations that just haven't got the strength to most probably even fight. And it's just, it's not, that shouldn't even be a thing, should it? It should be that they go to their GP and they get referred on and everything, you know, goes through a process. It shouldn't be that you're fighting to get anywhere.
Yeah. you're fighting to get anywhere, but also I think, you know, for so many people, I'm sure they're met with the what the hell is going on here.
Yeah. Or the GPs don't even know what ARFID is in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Which I think having that basic understanding is kind of the first step that we need to change in terms of
definitely.
You know, not having those stigmas about picky eating, or, you know, they'll just grow out of it or what have you. Because equally, you know, as I've had a number of people on the podcast, the whole rhetoric of they'll grow out of it, there's adults struggling with ARFID. And it's not, you know, it's not a childhood only thing. That I'd love to say that people, you know, snap out of it at some point. But it you know, it's not something that people grow out of.
No. And you saying about, you know, it affects adults too. I think this is what people forget. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, and a lot of, like, even with the media and things, a lot of it is heavily focused on children. And I think actually, why aren't they putting out that there is adults too? Because it is, you know, it affects everyone. It can affect any age. You know, it could come on at any point. It doesn't mean you've got to have it as a young child and you've grown with it. It is what it is. Anyone can have it. And I think it does seem at the minute everyone's like, oh, only kids get ARFID. And it's like, no, adults can too.
Mm, yeah. Well, and the theme for Eating Disorder Awareness Week this year is anyone can be affected by an eating disorder. And
which is brilliant.
What a fantastic theme to have.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think within the eating disorder community and the field, I think there's definitely an awareness of, you know, eating disorders do not just impact young white females. And there's a whole different range of eating disorders people can struggle with. But I definitely know that outside of the community, there's still that sort of, what do you mean, like, men can struggle with eating disorders, or, you know, it's not just anorexia. And so I think it's, you know, a really great initiative to have for the Eating Disorder Awareness Week campaign. So thank you so much for sharing your experience to debunk that stigma in itself.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, definitely got to debunk something, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Michelle, it's been, well, I want to say a pleasure. It has been a pleasure to speak to you, but I hate the experience that you've had. But I know that you've got some social media handles and some projects that you're working on. So if people are listening and thinking, I'd love to be part of the community, that, you know, I can find some hope, or, you know, speak to other people that are going through this, where can people go?
So either on my own social media page, ARFID Life UK. If you're local in Essex, I am currently setting up some sort of face-to-face sessions for other families with a local charity, which is really exciting. It's something that I always kind of talk to my family about and never actually thought it would happen. It's a bit of a strange one. It feels very odd and very surreal, but I am really looking forward to it. And me and a couple of mums actually that I met through Instagram, actually, I think one of them, I think I was the first person that ever actually contacted her.
Wow.
And then another mum, I think she was on Facebook. Well, the three of us are in the process of setting up our own little podcast all about ARFID, which is very similar to us just sitting here and having a chat, because, you know, I think the biggest thing that you can get from having this experience is someone who understands. I think, and if you can find that person, just finding someone who you can talk to freely, isn't it, with no judgment, no kind of, that don't happen to me. Everyone understands in some sense. And so, yeah, we've got a little podcast coming out, Three Mums, One Mission, ARFID. And but if anything, just contact me on my social media. I always answer people.
Well, you're absolutely amazing. And thank you so much for all the work that you're doing and sharing that experience with me today.
Thank you very much for having me.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.